Regional Hospital versus Cynthia Jones, Director of the Department of Medical Services. Let's see, we've got a cast of thousands on the docket. Who's arguing for the for Culpepper?
Captain Casper, Your Honor.
Ms. Casper, and for the Attorney General's Office?
Beth Guggenheim.
Thank you, Ms. Guggenheim.
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes, please.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes.
Okay, we'll be happy to hear from you when you're ready, ma'am.
May it please the court, my name is Katherine Casper, and I represent Culpepper Regional Hospital today. We're before you today on the December 19, 2013 decision of the Circuit Court for the City of Richmond, wherein the Circuit Court refused to overturn the November 20, 2012 final agency decision issued by the Department of Medical Assistance Services, or DMAS. That final agency decision found that Culpepper was required to refund to DMAS.
Let's cut to the chase here. I think we can make this. This seems to be a very straightforward,
simple issue. It is a very straightforward issue.
Everybody agrees that the regulations as well as federal law require certain things prior to reimbursement, or to, as a predicate to reimbursement, I'll put it that way. Can we agree on that?
I think we overall agree. I think the question is whether or not they require some specific certification language. We all agree that...
Well, everybody agrees there's no precise method.
That is correct.
But it seems to me... the certification is essentially a doctor's representation that admission is medically necessary.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And I think we can agree, at least in the abstract, that there's such a thing as elective surgery and elective procedures that may require admission that are not medically necessary.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Here we have a simple admission form signed by the doctor, and then a sort of an ex post facto statement that, you know, anytime the doctor admits somebody, it's medically necessary, essentially. And the question is whether that's good enough for, or close enough for government work. The government doesn't think so, apparently. So
the question is whether or not the information included in that admission order form complies with the documentation requirements, that are included in the one regulation in the manual. It's our position that if DMAS had wanted to require additional information to show that something, for example, was not elective, using the example that you just used, they could have done that.
The regulation simply says that there needs to be some document somewhere. I mean, it's not an onerous burden, it seems to me. There needs to be language to the effect that admission is medically necessary. And the documents we have contain no such language, do they?
Well, that's not exactly what the regulation and the manual require. If you read the manual provisions as well as the regulation, overall what's required are four things. They require that a physician certify that inpatient hospital services are necessary.
Isn't certify the key word?
They say that the physician must certify. So really the question...
And your position simply is the fact of admission constitutes the certification.
Our position is that it's the physician's signature that is his certification. Just as when an attorney signs a pleading, that is my, even though it doesn't say, I certify that the contents of this pleading are true, that's my certification.
Well, but that's, yeah. But that's the fact of what.
Isn't that even in the rules of court that when counsel signs a pleading, so the rule says that is your certification,
that is
the
true
signature, whereas here it doesn't say that.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is the difference between the legal world and the medical world.
The legal world, the rule kind of bridges that as opposed to in the medical. I mean, if you had something in the manual that said your representation and your admission that someone is admitted for medical treatment is to us a certification that's medically necessary, well, that would be one thing. But certification to me means something other than just, hey, go get treatment in the hospital.
And there's testimony at the formal appeal hearing where one of the physicians who works for Culpepper, who signed two of the admission order forms, was asked where does he believe that his certification is as a medical professional. And he pointed to the admission order form. And I can quote what he said in explaining that.
After the fact testimony, and understand why he would get his dander up that his integrity is questioned when he's being professional and, you know, exercising his medical judgment that, yes, I don't admit people for just for the fun of it. It's because they need medical treatment. But anyway, I just don't, I'll just put my cards on the table. I don't see how the simple admission of a patient falls within a separate certification that has to be done.
And with respect to your other arguments, I mean, how can you do it after the fact by these doctors? testify and say, well, yeah, it's medically necessary? How does that...
I don't think we've never said that there was an after... Everything that we have said is that it's their signature on the admission order form that was done at the time, that it's that signature. He was brought into the formal appeal hearing to testify, explaining what does that admission order form represent to him. So that was his explanation at the formal appeal hearing. Mm-hmm. It's always been the position of Culpepper that it's the signature that was done at that time of admission that constituted their certification. So we haven't said that there's an after-the-fact certification that is happening.
Why does common law contract law apply here?
Well, the court decided in 2009 in its psychiatric solutions decision, the only reason why Culpepper or any other provider is required to follow these regulations or the manual is because they've signed a provider participation agreement with DMS. Absent that, there would be no, they wouldn't be participating in the Medicaid program and they wouldn't be governed by these rules.
What is your argument with respect to Como's argument that waiver doesn't apply, your prior authorization argument? That waiver simply doesn't apply against the government.
We certainly believe that it does apply. We think that they pre-authorized all the treatment that was provided. They were aware that these patients were being admitted, and they authorized it at that time. I don't think they should be permitted to come back now and say that just because we're the government that there should be no credence given to that. I think if you pre-authorize some treatment and tell a provider to provide it, you can't later come back and say no. You can't.
Doesn't the manual say? Providers will be required to refund payments made by Medicaid if they're found to have billed Medicaid contrary to regulation or statute. I mean, look, I think these things are formalistic and punitive and unfair, but it seems to be what everybody's agreed to do.
Which, and to your point, if that is the case, to come back to our contract argument, I think that the only reason we have to follow what is written in that manual is because Culpepper has signed the provider participation agreement. Absent that, none of us would be in this situation because we wouldn't be providing care to these Medicaid beneficiaries. This court heard the First Stop case earlier this year. It was another case under the same manual provision. And in that case, it showed, I think, the instance where substantial compliance would not apply compared to this one. In First Stop, I believe
the cases are different. I agree with you.
The court used the word abysmal documentation. The same thing was true in Psychiatric Solutions. I was involved in that case, and looking at the records, it was difficult to tell what treatment at all was provided to anyone. If you look at the records in this case, there's testimony from the formal appeal hearing where the auditor, who was testifying as DMAS's expert, said herself that she could look at Culpepper's documentation, and she determined, based on that documentation, that the care was medically necessary. The care was provided. These are documents where the auditor herself testified and said, I did not cite them as...
I get that, and I'm sympathetic along with Judge McCullough's viewpoint, as a matter of fact. But that's not our job, is to revisit what the best public policy might be here. Our job is to apply fairly rigid standards of appellate review to these things. The Administrative Process Act limits us quite a great deal as well here. It seems to me, in applying that standard, we have to defer to the agency to some degree here, because clearly there's a rationale for requiring that taxpayer money only go to those services that are medically necessary. That's certainly a laudable public policy. In terms of implementing that, the agency, and I guess it's consistent with federal law as well, the agency has, through regulation, has required some sort of a certification of medical necessity. Here, they found the documentation insufficient to provide that certification. I understand your position is they were wrong about that, but in terms of appellate review, our job is to look at it and see, you know, given our the deference that we have to give them within their area of expertise, which certainly involves what is or isn't medically necessary, they found that simply stating a simple statement by the doctor that the patient should be admitted is insufficient to provide that information to them. How can we say they were wrong as a matter of law, given the degree of deference we have to give those kinds of decisions?
Even if that, I think our position and what I was just getting at is that even if that's the case, even if the court is to find that giving deference to the agency, the word certify or the word I certify as a physician that this care was medically necessary, if that's required, applying psychiatric solutions to this case, DMAS elected to enter into this contract. There's no dispute anywhere in this case that Culpepper provided the care that was bargained for. Culpepper provided these patients with inpatient treatment that DMAS's own auditor found was to be medically necessary. The only issue is whether that statement had to be in here or not. That was substantial compliance. There was no material breach. Everyone agrees that we provided this care. If DMAS has entered into that agreement and we're all in agreement that that care was provided, I think following Psychiatric Solutions and following the doctrine of substantial compliance, nonetheless, even I don't concede that we're required to have the word certify or a statement like that, but if we are, should be paid under that.
But in context, what we're talking about here is inpatient versus outpatient services.
Correct.
Outpatient services, I think, are less expensive, generally speaking, than inpatient services. So the issue is really one of, if we're going to spend taxpayer money for inpatient services, let's make sure they're medically necessary. You know, and I think it's pretty obvious for the doctor to have to certify that brain surgery requires inpatient treatment. That's one of those givens. But with modern medical advances, not everything requires a hospital visit anymore. You don't necessarily need to go to the hospital for every procedure. And so, but they leave it to the doctor to make the determination. And what I hear you arguing is that it's a reasonable inference that if a doctor says, I'm going to admit somebody, they're in effect saying it's medically necessary, but it isn't always the case. I said it could be an elective procedure of some sort that maybe the taxpayer shouldn't be footing the bill for. And that's where DMAS applies its expertise to determine what is or is not required.
Now, following up on what Judge Humphreys raised, suppose I called Dr. Bosley and said, I want a hair transplant. Maybe I should. And Dr. Bosley says, well, we got an admission to Mary Washington Hospital in Fredericksburg to do this. Would that mean that admission was medically necessary to have a hair transplant so that Medicaid would pay for it?
I understand your position, and that's where we get back into the elective surgery versus required surgery example.
If y'all had a stamp said medically necessary, boom. Admission medically necessary, certified medically necessary, we wouldn't be here.
But that same stamp could be used on a repair of a heart valve as well as a hair transplant, and just having
that's the physician's problem,
right? Yeah. But I don't know. I certainly understand your point, and I think that is definitely I understand the issue between elective versus a mandatory or life or death type surgery. But I think the use of a stamp wouldn't necessarily resolve the issue that we have here today, because you could still raise the issue of was it elective or not. I think whether or not something is an elective procedure is a little bit different whether or not it's medically necessary. Although I agree with you
but the manual doesn't say elective or not. Manual just says certified as medically necessary.
Correct. But as you pointed out, you could be medically necessary for an elective reason versus for...
Well, then they ought to change the manual. But
I think we can all agree DMAS, it would be nice if DMAS provided more guidance to physicians in this regard, but that's their call, not ours. So.
I think everyone would like the manual to be revised.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
All right, we'll hear from the Commonwealth, or I should say from the Director.
Good afternoon. My name is Beth Guggenheim. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Medical Assistance Services, which I'll refer to as DMAS or the department this afternoon. Just to clear something up regarding the overpayment, it was mentioned that that's in the manual if the requirement is not followed. That's also found in DMAS regulations that if the provider does not have a certification on file at the time of the utilization review, that a overpayment could result. So as far as the contract law argument that was mentioned earlier and that was only in the manual, that's actually in the regulation as well.
I mean, so with ordinary contracts, substantial compliance is the law of Virginia. So if I say deliver my couch by October 30, and it's delivered the next day, and I didn't make time of the essence, in the contract, and I can't show any prejudice, I don't really have, that's substantial compliance. And so, it seems to me that those ordinary background principles are expressly displaced by the agreement to abide by the manual and the regulations. So it's not that contract principles don't apply to a contract. It's that some of these backdrop principles that we pick up in ordinary contract cases have been set aside and based on the agreement of the parties, which is they're free to do.
Well, and this does differ here because you do have a federal regulation at issue, and the parties cannot contract their way out of compliance with a federal regulation. In fact, DMAS is responsible for enforcing federal regulations. Their financial federal participation requirements that are attached to that. DMAS does not enforce the federal requirements. There may be financial participation that is removed from the Commonwealth. So as far as contract law, this is taken clearly out of contract law because there is a federal regulation that the department must comply with as well.
There doesn't seem to be a dispute that this hospital was being abusive and feathering its own nest at the expense of the taxpayer or whatever. Is what's driving what appears to be fairly harsh punitive, right? Is it because if we don't comply with these federal statutes, then the federal government's going to impose penalties on Virginia, or is it that these auditors have to justify their existence and find fault? I mean, what's the driver behind this? Because it doesn't seem like the Commonwealth was out any money for unneeded treatment.
Your Honor, the Medicaid program, it is utilization review is the crux of the program. So documentation, without documentation, without the auditors being able to go in and see that, you don't have compliance with the Medicaid program. So
and it's very formalistic, I guess.
There is a purpose behind it. It is to ensure that the services that are being provided with the taxpayers' funds are only those that are medically necessary. So when an auditor looks and they see that certification, it's that the doctor...
But I thought here there was no dispute that these were medically necessary.
Well, but the nature of this is a utilization review. So the utilization review is not based upon medical necessity. It's only to look at the documentation.
And what we said in first stop.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the providers point to their general admission order. It's titled General Admission Order. There is nothing on that document that would indicate that it was also intended to be a certification. A certification...
I think the court seems to understand that argument.
And a certification could be on an order. It would just have to be clear. And if there is no identity anywhere in the record, then the federal requirement would essentially be meaningless at that point. As far as the difference between, there is a difference, as the court has pointed out, between an order and hospital certification. An order, it's merely an instruction from the doctor, and the certification is the statement that the inpatient services were needed. As you all have pointed out, Medicaid, it's a unique payer of hospital services. It's a lean program. It's funded by the taxpayers. This is an added safeguard, and the federal regulations actually state that this provision, it's a safeguard against unnecessary utilization of care and services.
The thing that amazes me about this case is that as between the federal government and the Commonwealth of Virginia, DMAS, and hospitals, three entities that are totally form-driven, as near as I can tell, there isn't a form for this certification. And it would, the amount of money spent on this appeal would print a whole lot of forms, it seems to me, for a lot of hospitals around the state to fill out with the certification. So,
Well, and the manual does provide that a stamp could be used that would meet the requirements. It's a simple statement again that the auditors can see that it's medically
clearly,
necessary.
If it's misrepresentation, that's fraud, and there's a recourse for that. You're talking about just auditors dotting I's and crossing T's and making sure there's documentation to support the federal requirements here, so that the state can get reimbursed for it.
That and to ensure that the services are medically necessary. That the auditors can see that.
Don't kill a few trees and we solve this problem.
Suppose Culpeper Regional Hospital wrote to y'all and said, tell us what language we should have on our admissions to qualify for reimbursement. What would y'all tell them?
Well, the department, they do give flexibility, as you're aware, to that. Culpepper did submit documentation up to 2.5 years after the admission order. And the statement that they used, which would have been sufficient had it been done on the, at the time it was the patient was admitted, it said, "I hereby certify that the medical record I reviewed clearly demonstrated that on," and it gives the date and patient.
So Culpepper's doing it now with that certification that y'all accept.
I don't know if they're doing that now. That was documentation that was submitted later on behalf of the patients that were under review.
So back to my question. Suppose Culpepper's counsel says, "Tell us what we need to say." What would y'all tell them?
Well, the department should point to the federal regulation. The language of the federal regulation is clear. It says certify the need for inpatient hospital services and to sign and date on that when that patient is admitted. So if Culpepper followed that language, the physician, "I certify the need for inpatient hospital services," on that order where the inpatient hospital services were recorded, then that would have been sufficient. As far as the documentation that was submitted after the audit, as this court found in First Stop, it can't be considered that because essentially that was documentation that was substituting the required certification. This court stated a provider is entitled to present evidence at the hearing, but it cannot be used to circumvent or displace the documentation requirements. Your Honors, the as far as the policy behind the federal regulation, that's been talked about a little bit, the purpose behind it, DMAS must enforce that regardless of the policy behind the federal regulation. Your Honors, if you have no further questions, I just conclude by asking that this court uphold the lower court's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Guggenheim. Ms. Casper?
Thank you. If I may, first, Your Honor, just briefly to readdress Judge Humphrey's question on the agency deference, I wanted to point the court to a case that this court handed down in 2011. It's Virginia Department of Medical Assistance Services versus Patient Transport. It was reported at 58 Virginia App 328, and we cited to it in our brief. In that case, it was held that when the sole determination by an agency is whether documentation complies with the regulation, the documentation, quote, either complies with the regulation or it does not. No interpretation by the agency is necessary, nor is the agency's specialized competence govern the court's review, end quote. So I think in this case, this is one where this is really all we're asking them to do, is to say whether or not the documentation Culpepper completed complies with what the regulation and this guidance document have asked for them to do. So this isn't a case where we give the same type of deference to DMAS as we may in another circumstance. Second, the First Stop case continues to come up, and I just wanted to address the difference between First Stop and this case, and I think that there are two. One is that in First Stop, before the court, there were some very clear manual provisions. The manual very clearly said in First Stop, this is the form that you must use in order to document that this care was provided. If you do not completely fill out this form, you will have to reimburse us. That's completely different than the manual provision we have here, which specifically says providers have flexibility in determining how to certify.
But there is still that manual provision that says if you don't follow the required documentation, you will be reported.
That's correct, and I agree with you.
So it's broader,
provision is there.
And you're right that in First Stop it was much more specific. But still, that's a tough hurdle to clear because the manual is express.
I agree, and I agree that provision does appear in the manual. I think, though, that when we have seen that there are cases where if, as Ms. Guggenheim pointed out, it's possible that DMAS can say, you must say in your documents, I certify that this patient, or that it was medically necessary to provide this patient.
But can we read that any more broadly than just that no magic words are required? For example, it could be phrased, outpatient treatment is contraindicated, that, you know, by inference that would suggest inpatient care.
That is
so
certainly.
No magic words, but something that puts DMAS on notice that it's medically necessary.
That's certainly true, Your Honor. I know I'm out of time, but if you want to
briefly conclude, go right ahead.
I believe, as we pointed out earlier, we are here because we believe that we have certainly strictly complied with the requirements of the manual and the regulation. Even if not, though, I think this is clearly a case, unlike Psychiatric Solutions and unlike First Stop, where the documentation here is clear. You can tell these patients receive the services. I think if substantial compliance ever had a place in a case between DMAS and a provider, this is certainly it. So we would ask the court either because we strictly complied or substantially required to overturn the circuit court's decision. We would also ask that they remand to the circuit court for entry of an order awarding attorney's fees in accordance with the statutes and regulation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down to Greek counsel and the court will be adjourned.